Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have bad, good, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And trust me, the crazy one's also really, really bad. So, David, a little bit out of order today, but I think it'll make sense for folks as we go about our discussions today. Let's start with the bad, and this is the news that broke on Thursday evening and just has jaws hitting the floor all over the country, and especially, I would imagine, in Broward County, Florida. The sheriff there, Scott Israel, who folks are probably pretty familiar with by now, came out to update the case and made an announcement about the sheriff's deputy, who had been the school resource officer at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, and what he did and didn't do during the mass shooting. Here are a number of clips starting with this.
Scott Peterson was absolutely on campus through this entire event.
And then, after looking at the video, the sheriff drew this conclusion.
Well, what I saw was a deputy arrive at the west side of Building 12, take up a position, and he never went in.
Asked how he reacted to seeing that.
Devastated, sick to my stomach. There are no words. I mean, these families lost their children. We lost coaches.
And finally, the reporter followed up wondering what Peterson should have done.
Was he there when the shooter was still inside the building?
Yes, he was.
And so what should he have done?
Went in, addressed the killer, killed the killer.
David, here was your tweet from yesterday. I'm amazed at the number of people who are excusing the apparent failure of the school resource officer to engage the shooter because the shooter was armed with the allegedly almighty AR-15. That SRO's job is to fight and, if necessary, die for those kids. Heartbreaking, infuriating. And David, the shocking thing is the amount of people who condemned you for suggesting that this was the guy's job.
This was a gut punch, this revelation, because it's one thing to hear about all of the failures before the shooting, you know, all these specific tips that were received. I mean, the guy did almost everything but call the cops and say, I'm going to show up at the high school on such and such date with such and such weapon. I mean, he broadcast his intentions loud and clear. That was a gut punch enough. But then to hear there's something so poignant and immediate and devastating about hearing the news of a guy in uniform with a gun apparently cowering outside while inside there were young kids and teachers who are exhibiting more courage, who are completely unarmed and trying to save lives. I mean, it's hard to get more devastating than that. But what shocked me was the number of people who said, I don't disagree with what he did. It would have been a suicide mission to go up against a person with an AR-15. This just proves that a good guy with a gun can't stop a bad guy with a gun. I mean, it was as if the dictates of the gun control argument meant excusing cowardice. Let's just deal with a couple of facts here. I mean, number one, a good guy with a gun, even a guy armed with an inferior weapon, can stop a bad guy with a gun. I mean, the Capitol Police at the Alexandria shooting that, you know, so horribly injured Steve Scalise were fighting a guy with a quote-unquote assault weapon and pinned him down. And then there were people who are, as I said, completely unarmed inside Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School who intervened anyway, even though they're completely unarmed, when it was an actual true real suicide mission. And besides, that's the guy's job. When you put on the uniform, you're declaring to the world that you are willing, not wanting, but willing to die if necessary and to fulfill your duty to protect your community. And then the other thing that I saw that was really unbelievable was, well, you can't judge him unless you've been under fire yourself. So it was basically, you know, unless you're a combat infantryman, unless you're Chris Kyle, I don't want to hear from you. But the virtue of courage and the vice of cowardice, we can evaluate and judge even if, and this is really important, we don't know how we'd react in a similar crisis. It's one thing to say he should have entered that building even at great personal risk, which is absolutely true. It's another thing to say that I would have entered the building in similar circumstances. That's what you have to be humble about. because none of us knows how we'd react to a crisis until a crisis occurs. And so I don't read, when people are condemning him, I don't read that as to say all of these people saying, I would have done better. But it's people saying, we need courage from men in uniform. Everybody who's remotely aware of history knows that there are men in uniform who fail all the time, even in our military. The most professional and lethal fighting force in the history of the world, there are men in our military who fail that test. I mean, I saw that when I was in Iraq. But that's why, because human beings are fallen, and every molecule of your body in a deadly situation is screaming for you to be safe. You have to rely not just on inspiration, but also condemnation to build courage. That's why militaries reward valor and punish dereliction of duty. You have to have a culture that doesn't just embrace heroes, but also condemns cowards. That's the way you build, and that's the way you get people to overcome that sort of inherent desire to cower in the corner. And so, I mean, there's a lot to this. It's like unpeeling a philosophical onion. but the bottom line's really clear. When he put on that uniform, he was declaring his intention to protect the community. He failed to do that. We can understand why he failed without justifying why he failed. And if the path to gun control is now going through excusing cowardice, then I think the gun control argument is going to lose.
David, you mentioned obviously all the red flags that popped up before, and we saw the tip that went unreported to the local field office through the FBI. There were the multiple phone calls to the local authorities. There's quibbling over how many. The sheriff the other night at the CNN town hall said 23. Some have said 39. And even at the town hall, the sheriff was saying, well, which specific call should we have acted on to actually do something here? Well, the Miami Herald has reported on this, and part of their report says, quote, in November, a tipster called BSO, Broward Sheriff's Office, to say Cruz could be a school shooter in the making. But deputies did not write up a report on that warning. It came just weeks after a relative called urging the office to seize his weapons.
Oh, man. This is so discouraging. It's so discouraging. I was talking last night with a colleague, and we're racking our brains to think, in the recent history of these horrible mass shootings, is there a single instance with more red flags than this one? The comprehensive failures here, and then the idea that this is going to be the shooting that's going to tip over people into trusting the government more to enact more regulations, it strikes me as really interesting. This is the shooting that has illustrated that when government failures here led to extreme vulnerability and tragedy. It's just so sad. It's so infuriating. And then to see officials from that same government posturing and shaming gun rights advocates when they have those skeletons in their closet, it's infuriating.
Absolutely. And I think the point you make about the government being the panacea to all this, we've talked about this before. We maybe even talked about it the day after the shooting last week, David, where you talked about how even the red flags we knew at that time shows that competence is sometimes hard to find at this level. Now here we are 8-9 days later, and we're seeing the extent of it to this point that we know of it. And it's just stunning. Absolutely stunning. And as you said, of course, if that's the way that the gun control argument's going to go, is that we're supposed to be relying on government to protect us, and hey, the police will get there in time and so forth. This story puts the lie to that, but it certainly doesn't make it a given that the police will get there on time, which we've already known. And as we shift to our good martini, David, you have written for National Review Online, essentially a defense of our right to assault weapons, certainly for those who ought to have them and can pass the background check and so forth. And you talk about it in a number of ways, which I'll obviously let you elaborate on. First of all, you talk about Justice Scalia's rationale in the Heller decision back in 2008 about what weapons are for and what type of power they ought to have. You talk about if we give up assault weapons, we'll be at a firepower disadvantage for meeting up with the bad guys. And then, of course, there's, you know, the Second Amendment, which is the trump card on all of this. And while we're not supposed to necessarily be able to match the 3rd Cavalry Regiment, as you put it, we are supposed to give pause to our government.
I wrote this article because there's been a huge wave of people saying we should ban assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And I just wanted to sort of go back, and because a lot of times what happens is when we have these gun control debates, they either get screechy or wonky. And by that, I mean, they when they get screechy, they're like, well, you've got blood on your hands. You know, the name calling that we see that dominates Twitter, and that doesn't do anything. It just hardens people in their positions. And then sometimes it gets wonky. It's sort of like, well, let me show you this chart of gun violence in Great Britain and Australia and guns per capita and compare it. And then immediately, you know, you'll see the counter chart that comes in and says, well, let me show you this chart showing an increase of concealed carry permits and corresponding decline in violent, you know. So it just goes back and forth. But we rarely talk about first principles. What is it that the Second Amendment protects? Someone asked me the other day, I said, do you think that there is a God-given right to a gun, that you have an unalienable natural law right to own a gun? And I said, let me put it this way. And this is the path that I traced. I believe you have an unalienable inherent right to self-defense. That's the unalienable right. That's the God-given right, is the right to self-defense. Defend yourself and defend your family. That's an unalienable right. For that unalienable right to be effective, to be meaningful, you have to be able to defend yourself with, and this is why Scalia put it in the Heller decision, that weapons in common use. So, you know, for example, if all I have is sort of like is a broadsword, which would be a weapon in common use and, you know, the 14th century, I don't have an effective right of self-defense if my foreseeable opponent has a Glock. So for your right for self-defense to be effective, you have to have access to the common weapons in use in your era, in your time. So this is, you know, this is sort of the answer to the people, I guess, who say the Second Amendment was designed to protect the right of people who own a musket. No. You know, imagine trying to defend your family with a flintlock pistol. I mean, you know, that's absurd. So they apply to the weapons in common use at the time. And what a lot of people, and I feel like this is something that's part of the knowledge gap that exists in the gun control debate. When you hear assault rifle and when you hear high capacity magazine, a lot of people who don't live in gun owning areas of the country think of an abnormal weapon, an abnormally dangerous weapon. In other words, something that's not in common use. When the reality is, these kinds of weapons basically define common use. So an AR-15 is the in many years has been the single best-selling rifle sold in the United States. The single best-selling, the various variants of the AR-15. A high-capacity magazine, which the law usually defines as a magazine containing more than 10 rounds, is the default magazine size, high capacity, for a huge number of semi-automatic pistols that people own. I have a Ruger SR9. It's got a high-capacity magazine that was standard issue with the pistol. So if you're talking about a ban on quote-unquote assault rifles corresponding with a ban on high-capacity magazines, what you are saying to law-abiding citizens is you are not entitled to legally possess weapons that are in common use in this era. And so therefore, the people who will have the weapons in common use are the criminals who are your foreseeable opposition. So for example, to take what happened in Parkland, that guy had a weapon in common use with a magazine in common use. And the response to that folks on the left say is, well, you should respond to him and be limited to responding to him with something substantially inferior to that, that's how you should respond. And so I tried to go back to that first principle to talk about this, because there is so much ignorance about what the Second Amendment actually protects. And then there was this other point that I also made that a lot of people just jumped on like crazy, saying, you know, I said also the Second Amendment, and this is clearly outlined in the Heller decision, is sort of the ultimate emergency ripcord against tyranny. Of course, I do not think that a gang of, you know, local Tennessee dads could stop a U.S., you know, infantry battalion. I mean, come on. Of course not.
Right.
Of course not. But that's not what we're talking about here. It's really funny. You see the same people who say it's insane for Americans to think that they could pacify Afghanistan, where, you know, you're fighting the Taliban, who have, you know, mainly AK-47s. so they'll say it's insane to believe the American forces can pacify Afghanistan and then say, turn around and say to an armed population where there's, you know, what, maybe 100 million plus Americans who have weapons. Well, it's insane to think that widespread civilian gun ownership can deter United States government. Those are completely inconsistent views. The fact of the matter is the right of civilian ownership of weapons is not rooted in the ability of civilians to defeat the United States Army in a fair fight. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the existence of an armed citizenry just acts as a deterrent against tyranny. It acts as a deterrent. It's not the cure-all. Nothing is the cure-all. It acts as a deterrent. And so that's the issue. And it strikes me as just beyond bizarre for someone to argue that there would be zero deterrent in an armed citizenry if, you know, you had a government that sought to impose its will on a divided population where the armed services themselves would probably be divided. Law enforcement would probably be divided. Of course, an armed population has a deterrent effect. Of course it does. That's not the same thing as saying it can defeat the United States Army. Of course not. There is no military force in the world that right. can defeat the exactly. United States Army.
No, that's exactly right. And David, I'm really glad you brought up the absurdity of the argument that the Second Amendment was designed to apply to weapons available at the time, especially coming from people on cable television, because if we're going to apply the same principle, the freedom of the press then ought to be limited to the media devices at the time, which would be 1790s era printing presses. So cable news, radio, internet, obviously, would all go by the wayside, which would not be good for you or me. But that's the equivalent they're trying to make here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you can immediately expose it by just saying, do you have a right of self-defense? And virtually every human being says, yes, yes, absolutely, I have a right of self-defense. And then the next thing you said, well, shouldn't that right be effective? You know, and shouldn't it be? And so does that mean that you're at that point, the argument that, well, you're limited to 18th century weapons, flintlock musket and, you know, maybe a nice hefty cavalry saber it just gets immediately absurd.
Right.
I never, when I hear that, I think immediately think the person I'm dealing with who's arguing about muskets is either making this argument in bad faith or out of extreme ignorance. The fact of the matter is a citizen militia with muskets was on much greater parity
right.
with a standing army in the 18th century than citizens with AR-15s are on parity with the military today.
Exactly. Even,
so,
see but, Revolutionary but, yeah. War results.
Yeah, CEG, our own revolution, yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to our crazy martini now. And now that we've given the left some well-deserved correction here, let's talk about a major stain for the right. Eric Greitens is the governor of Missouri, elected in 2016. David, you talk about a poster boy conservative candidate. This guy served as a Navy SEAL. He's got Hollywood casting family. And then earlier this year, we got the revelation that just before announcing his candidacy, back in 2015, he had carried on an extramarital affair with his hairdresser. And at that time, a local Missouri television station had gotten the phone recording of the mistress and her husband, they're now divorced, where she explained that Eric Greitens had not only seduced her, but also had taken a photo of her against her will in a compromising position and said that he would use it against her if she ever talked about their relationship. So now there's a development. Greitens has been indicted. Here is Lindsay Davis of Good Morning America on ABC News.
On Thursday, a grand jury indicted Eric Greitens, charging him with invasion of privacy, alleging the Missouri governor, the defendant, knowingly photographed his mistress in a state of full or partial nudity without the knowledge and consent of her and uploaded it in a way that allowed access via a computer.
Now, Greitens, in the limited interviews that he's done on this, says he admits to the affair and he's very sorry for that, but he does not admit at all to the blackmail or the assault. There was also an allegation that he slapped her at one point, and he says that never happened. And so there, he and his legal team are fighting to get these charges dismissed. They say it's all bogus. David, given what we do know about this story, I'm not sure he gets the benefit of the doubt here anymore. And obviously, if the photo exists, that'll be the determining factor. But what a colossal collapse for a guy Republicans thought was a future star for them.
There's a lot to think about here. You know, first, this is a reminder that virtue in one area of your life is not a guarantee of virtue in all areas of your life. I mean, you know, here you have a guy who served honorably and bravely, served his country honorably and bravely, and then fell into this, even by his own admission, like really tawdry affair. Everyone has to be held accountable. You just can't look at a biography of a person and presume they're going to exhibit the virtues necessary for high office. You know, and then, you know, what to make of these claims? I mean, if they're true, he's got to resign pronto. He says they're not true. I mean, we're just going to have to wait and see. And then finally, I just got to say this. What's a SEAL doing with a hairdresser? I mean, come on. SEALs have barbers, you know? I mean, what? Does he need a lot of product in his hair? I don't know what's going on here with that. So, yeah, lots to unpack.
He's fighting for his political survival. I'm not sure how long that's going to last. David, I don't have a firm grasp on Missouri politics here, but it would seem to be that the handwriting's on the wall here, probably.
I would think if the facts are quite simply he had an affair and none of this other stuff happened, he might be able to survive sort of given the new Trump established rules for Republican politicians, which is multiple affairs are no impediment to political success. So he might be able to survive on that basis, although he still has committed the sin of hypocrisy, which some people seem to think is a much greater sin than the sin of adultery. But if any element of this additional criminal complaint is true, I mean, he's just got to be done. We'll have to wait and see. But hey, you know, there's not one drama in America right now. I don't know if you followed the story of the Nashville mayor and her affair with her bodyguard.
I've heard about it a little bit. Yeah.
Which has included morning, apparently lots of morning trysts recorded on camera. Or morning visits with the bodyguard recorded on camera to the Nashville cemetery. So life just gets weird in American life is getting weird in American politics and getting weirder every day.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I had heard about that affair. I did not know those details, and I'm glad I didn't just eat. So, David, on that less than thrilling note, we're going to call time for the week. Thanks for being with us the past couple of days, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Well, thanks for having me.
David French.
Appreciate it as always.
Oh, of course. David French of National Review. And for Jim Garrity, Jim will be back on Monday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great weekend, and please tune in for the next 3 Martini Lunch.